You're tuning into new information. If we're going to take anything away from that, and that flattening the curve was the original like reasoning for the mask. Do we have time to mention? I'm going to mention one thing. There's this thing on TikTok. It's a meme, but there was this anti-mask woman who was like, this is the mask that like they require that my child wears to school, and this is a sneeze, and then like takes like a spray bottle of Windex and like drapes it over it, and just like, it's like, look at this, there's droplets coming through, which is funny because that's not how it works. Your child is not a Windex bottle. And so then people were making fun of her by like putting a hose through it. It's like, look at this, this is a sneeze. Or someone's like, this is what they want you to do with the mask, and like put it in the microwave. And like, this is ridiculous.
Oh, TikTok, the whole universe. Well, we are just about out of time and got 20 seconds left.
Yeah.
I want to say, have a great weekend. Thank you, Althea. Thank you, Sonia. This has been The Gap on KBOO Portland.
See you next time.
See ya. Happy weekend. We run this.
You're tuned in to listener-supported community radio, KBOO Portland.
In the 1980s, Portland, Oregon was a sleepy city that largely existed outside of the national spotlight.
Downtown Portland cleared out after 5 p.m., and city buses rolled through quiet streets populated by hobos, punks, drunks, drug dealers, and street kids. Some of these kids were targeted by white nationalists and became neo-Nazi skinheads.
Late one night in 1988, Mulugeta Seurat was beaten with a baseball bat and left for dead.
Three white kids who killed Seurat weren't outside agitators, but members of Eastside White Pride, a neo-Nazi street gang.
By the mid-90s, racist skinheads had disappeared from the streets of Portland. How did this happen?
It Did Happen Here is a documentary podcast that chronicles how immigrants, civil rights activists, and militant youth worked together with the diversity of tactics to drive white supremacist street gangs out of Portland.
The first episode will be released November 13th, the 32nd anniversary of the murder of Mulugeta Seurat.
Stay tuned.
Hello, ahlan wa sahlan, and welcome to Arab Voices on Houston Pacifica Radio, listener-sponsored, commercial-free KPFT 90.1 FM. With live streaming, podcasting, and online archive of previous shows at both kpft.org and arabvoices.net. This is Saeed, executive producer and host of Arab Voices. This show is syndicated and it airs on other radio stations in different states in the U.S. Today on Arab Voices, we will air the Palestine Center's 2020 Edward Said Memorial Lecture with Daphne Muse, a writer, poet, cultural broker, and veteran of the civil rights movement, discussing the similarities and intersections between Palestinian and Black struggles for equality and justice, as well as their implications for the future. But before we listen to that lecture and some of the questions and answers that followed her talk, I'd like to thank those who called in recently with pledges to KPFT in support of Arab Voices. Many thanks to Nabil, Jean, Alex, Serene, Ruth Ann, Miriam, and others who wanted to remain anonymous. And as KPFT continues its fall membership drive, I'd like to ask for your support and contributions to KPFT, this unique commercial-free community radio station, because KPFT is currently in membership drive, and that is a great opportunity to upgrade your listenership to listener sponsor and become a member of the KPFT family. Most of you, if not all, know that KPFT is 100% financed by listeners like you, and it does not rely on the corporate world to operate, so please give us a call right now at 713-526-5738 and make that tax-deductible contribution to support your community radio station. That's 713-526-5738. You can also make a pledge online at kpft.org or text the word GIVE to 713-526-5738. I mentioned this is a unique radio station, and there is no doubt about that. It is unique in so many ways, like the diverse range of programming it provides, like this program, Arab Voices, that has been on KPFT for over 18 years. Yes, over 18 years of weekly programming. Hundreds of topics and over 1,000 expert guests appearing on this program from around the globe. So if you appreciate what this station has been doing, we ask you to support it and keep Arab Voices and other programs on the air. Please make that call and make a pledge of any amount, whether it's $60 or $360. Call 713-526-5738 or make a pledge online at kpft.org or text the word GIVE to 713-526-5738. Your support is greatly appreciated. On October 7th, 2020, the Palestine Center in Washington, D.C. held the annual Edward Said Memorial Lecture, and the guest speaker was Daphne Muse, a writer, poet, cultural broker, and veteran of the civil rights movement, who talked about the similarities and intersections between Palestinian and Black struggles for equality and justice, as well as their implications for the future. Let's listen in now to that lecture and some of the questions and answers that followed.
Good afternoon, everyone. Thank you all for joining us today. My name is Muhammad Muhammad. I'm the executive director here at the Jerusalem Fund and Palestine Center. As always, we are delighted to have you all with us, and we look forward to the day when we can have you with us in person as well. One quick thing before we begin, as many of you know, we are a nonprofit organization. And if you enjoy these events, please consider supporting us, whether through a donation or simply by spreading the word about us to your family and friends. We would really appreciate that. And you can donate or learn more about us on our website, which is www.thejerusalemfund.org. For this year's Edward Said Memorial Lecture, we are very pleased and honored to have with us Daphne Muse, who will be giving a talk titled The Intersections of Our Resistance and the Legacies We Leave Future Generations. We're also happy to have with us Said Arakat, who is a longtime accomplished journalist, analyst, and professor, and is the Washington Bureau Chief for the Palestinian Al-Quds Daily newspaper, and also a member of our Palestine Center Committee. And he will be moderating today's event. Thank you both so much for joining us today. In our Edward Said Memorial Lecture today, Daphne Muse will discuss the similarities and intersections between Palestinian and Black struggles for equality and justice, as well as their implications for the future. Muse is a writer, poet, cultural broker, and veteran of the civil rights movement. When she was a teenager, her parents seeded an enduring bond with the people of Palestine. She became an activist while a student at Fisk University, working with the anti-war movement and the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. Her activism evolved, during her time managing Drum and Spear Bookstore and while serving as a secretary to the legal defense team for the Angela Davis trial. Her essays, reviews, and social commentaries have appeared in scores of publications, including Black Scholar, The Atlantic, This Week in Palestine, and have been aired on NPR. As a writer, lecturer, retired educator, and in partnership with the Imagining America Consortium, she continues to mentor activists and creatives around the world, and she has lived in Northern California since 1971. Without further ado, I will hand it off to Daphne Muse.
Thank you so much. The intersections of our resistance and the legacies we leave future generations. I sincerely wish to thank the Jerusalem Fund Palestine Center for inviting me to give the 2020 Edmund Said Memorial Lecture in a year more than any other now determining the fate of Palestine, my own country, the United States, and the overall future of our planet, Mother Earth. Said's visionary courage and intellect brought a truly clarifying lens to how the boots of imperialism and settler colonialism crushed so many efforts to seed a viable future for Palestine and all colonized peoples. My heartfelt thanks also goes out to poet Edmund Garib for putting my name forward and rekindling a transformative connection that was made in 1970. As he sips his black coffee from the Afterlife Cafe, the spirit of my father extends gratitude for inviting me and my 98-year-old mother, who to this day is a devotee of Yasser Arafat, and reminds me of the responsibility that comes with this honor. On the shores of the Mediterranean Sea at Gaza, teenage boys surf, sit, and sometimes sleep, seeking refuge from the ravaging, pillaging, and poisoning of the land on which they live. They often speak in hushed tones for fear of the waves carrying their voices back to the Israeli soldiers stalking and uprooting the land where their ancestors planted olive and fig trees, the legacies they wanted them to inherit. They speak of their dreams of joining the World Surf League, becoming rappers or engineers rebuilding the infrastructure of their country, or the alchemists of resistance who pull a single thread that can unravel the most massive tapestry woven with lies, treachery, and the lethal knots of settler colonialism. In Hebron, girls work alongside their mothers preparing mansaf, bamia, and fried green tomatoes, a beloved dish in black cuisine as well. They too study hard to realize their dreams of becoming cellists, doctors, astronomers, and future leaders of their country. Like the boys in Gaza, they navigate a maze of Israeli police security checkpoints to sit before teachers who give them treasures of knowledge. While black children don't have to navigate checkpoints, many live in neighborhoods where the lines of racial demarcation are clear, and members of the Movement for Black Lives, parents, elders, and community members escort them across barriers shaped by racial and class policies in places like Ferguson, Missouri, and Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Thousands of miles away at the shore of Florida's historic American beach at Amelia Island, a social refuge for black people since 1935, families listen to their young speak in animated tones of becoming intergalactic surgeons, directors of Afrofuturistic films, historians documenting social justice movements, and city planners bringing back black communities destroyed by the architects of white supremacy. Many live where walls obstruct their dreams, and screams from their nightmares far too often pierce the night air as blood and bodies flood the streets from Gaza to Louisville and Ramallah to Rochester. The children whose ancestors were human cargo on slave ships that crossed the Atlantic were born into whirlwinds of struggle and resistance mounted by 19th century abolitionist Harriet Tubman, 20th century poet June Jordan, who sing a song of Palestine, pays tribute to Arab feminists, and now the veterans of civil rights movement. And this generation of Palestinians are standing on the shoulders of 20th century freedom fighters, including Ribi Muhammad and William Nasser, and the organizations including the PLO, the Palestinian Liberation Organization, that wage parallel struggles to secure Palestinian independence, to secure Palestine's independence as an autonomous state. In 1964, Malcolm X met with the newly formed PLO, while many of our esteemed writers, including James Baldwin, Toni Morrison, Alice Walker, and so many black people who work along with Palestinians at car manufacturing plants in Detroit, have stood in solidarity with the people of Palestine. This generation of blacks and Palestinians are coming into formation on the beats of Beyoncé, Palestinian rappers Shajib plus Al Nathir, and scholarship and activism of the co-founders of Blacks for Palestine, Christian Davis Bailey, and scholar Dr. Najime Ali. The tradition of alliances and intersections runs with Fred Hampton Jr., legendary artist Twista, and Rebel Diaz hosting an Existence is Resistance benefit concert for Palestinian youth. Historically and presently, there are clear parallels between the oppression suffered by Blacks and Palestinians, from racial profiling to the incarceration of youth to whites-only roads, neighborhoods, buses, housing, and school. White supremacy in the United States closely resembles the occupation of Palestine. Companies like G4S profit off the racist mass incarceration of both African Americans in the United States and Palestinians in Palestine. And while our cultural luminaries have aligned themselves with this struggle, so too do thousands of others. Kathy Shields, who works very closely with the Middle Eastern Children's Alliance, noted, "Black Lives Matter sent representatives to Palestine and Hazem as director of Shuruk, a community organization in Dachau refugee camp near Bethlehem, and met with them. Following the murder of Trayvon Martin and the acquittal of George Zimmerman, Palestinians were among the first to send messages of solidarity to protesters. When Hurricane Katrina hit New Orleans in 2005, Palestinians from Dachau refugee camp sent donations to help with relief efforts for the Black community. My own commitment to Palestine was forged in my parents' home when I was in the ninth grade. Both were working class civil servants engaged in what I have now come to recognize as discrete resistance. I developed a passion for geography and at one point wanted to be a cartographer. My mother, Betty Goshen Muse, was a clerk in the passport division of the State Department. She brought home interesting stamps and brochures about other countries. Among them was one about Palestine. I have no recollection of the specific contents, only that I was intrigued by the shape of what Palestine was at that time. Dad had a day job as a clerk for the Department of Defense. In the evenings and on weekends, he worked as a private butler. As an invisible Black man in settings where the voices of world power discussed their strategies for political and personal conquest at dinner parties, embassy receptions, and bastions of patriarchy, including the Metropolitan Club, considered the most exclusive club in the country, my father knew a coup was going to happen before it hit the front pages of the Washington Post. Overheard the orchestration of coming wars and witnessed the political and personal indiscretions carried out by power mongers and ruling class elites. Without going into specifics of what they heard or often saw in their jobs, they discussed current events in the vernacular of Black working class people, noting that Palestinians were treated just as horribly as we were. And Yasser Arafat was an icon in our home, who, whenever he came on the evening news or 60 Minutes, where he appeared with some frequency, or was reported on in the Washington Post or Christian Science Monitor, my parents' refrain was, "And what did Yasser say today?" His appearance in the US media was frequent, and he was defiantly charismatic. I began to think that maybe Palestinians were our secret cousins. My parents also followed the commentaries and reporting by Kentucky-born Helen Thomas, who would go on to become a senior White House correspondent. Her expertise on the Middle East was invaluable, and Dad would see her at parties he served across town. In one of those that is the way my life rolls stories, She and I became instant friends after meeting at a book signing in 2009. She even invited me for dinner at the Press Club in 2010 for the State of the Union address. During those 4 years, we packed a lifetime of friendship over long conversations and our ever-growing concerns as to the very precarious future of Palestine and her in-depth knowledge of the Middle East. I transformed my parents' discreet resistance, though, into activism and onto other platforms, including incorporating works by Palestinian writers in curriculum projects on which I worked across the country and into the multicultural children's literature course I taught at Mills College. Also, for 22 years, along with troves of Black picture books and young adult fiction, I handed out children's books instead of candy at Halloween, including those by prolific poet and author Naomi Shihab Nye. Feeling compelled to reflect on so much that we have in common, I also use my voice to write a series of articles for This Week in Palestine, including one on the intersection of Black and Palestinian comedians. My home became an oasis in the diaspora, where strategy sessions for social justice movements were conducted for writers, artists, filmmakers, and activists who sought refuge or whom I hosted to perform, including a prize-winning poet, Alice Walker, prize-winning poet, Gwendolyn Brooks, activist, Afeni Shakur, and her son, Tupac, civil rights icon, Rosa Parks, and Palestinian poet and artist, Manar Harb. But long before meeting Thomas, my most unwavering solidarity with Palestine came in 1970, when Drum and Spear Press took the radical step of publishing Enemy of the Sun, Palestinian Resistance, an anthology of Palestinian resistance. The voices of Naomi Shihab Nye, Nasir Arouri, and Tawfiq Zayad resonated powerfully, introducing a more global relationship to their works. In the 1960s, poet and editor Arouri, who went on to become an internationally recognized scholar, activist, and expert on Middle East politics, United States foreign policy in the Middle East, and human rights. Edmond Garib, now a journalist and senior scholar at the Palestine Center of Jerusalem Fund for Education and Community Development in Washington, D.C., had been inspired at a conference in Beirut to collaborate on editing this anthology. Guided by their vision for the future of Palestine and a mutual passion for poetry, after a series of rejections, the book was taken to Carl Senna, an acquisitions editor at Beacon Press. 3 weeks after his enthusiastic response to the manuscript, he told Garib and his colleagues that Beacon would not publish the book. Senna suggested Garib and his colleagues take the manuscript to Drum and Spear Press. This small independent press was based in Washington, D.C., and founded in 1968 by Charles Carb Jr. and a devoted cadre of fellow activists from the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. On the heels of the assassination of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. and the rising Black Power movement, which awakened the consciousness of the city and country, Anne Forrester Holloway provided the kind of leadership that resulted in the publication of the anthology. I managed the day-to-day matters of the bookstore at the time, and the modest press run of 10,000 copies became a bestseller. It became part of the curriculum at the University of Massachusetts and was added to the personal libraries of prisoners across the country, including Soledad brother George Jackson. A copy of the book was found in his cell after he was murdered. Their vision and perseverance resulted in a powerful literary victory. And within a year, that anthology was published. It became a launching point for the voices of a generation of Palestinian poets, including award-winning writer Naomi Shihab Nye. Sami al-Qasim's poem, Enemy of the Sun, echoes the intersectionality of the civil rights movement, African liberation fronts, and hundreds of post-colonial liberation movements across the globe. As reflected in the sometimes searing and poignant poems, the Palestinian people are complex and dynamic as any other nation of people, determined to claim their history and land from the claws of oppression. 3 weeks before he was murdered in an explosion, Ralph Featherstone, who managed the bookstore at the time, and in that particular moment, I will always treasure, he introduced me to Ghareeb and two of the other editors of the anthology. Repeated harassment by the US government forces, most especially the FBI, who assigned me my own agent, Jim South, and the running of a business based on what I call capitalism, with whom the store's core vision did not align, resulted in the closure of the press in 1971 and the store in 1974. The title poem in this elixir of poetry encapsulates the intersection of historical and contemporary movements demanding that Black Lives Matter and Palestine become an independent state under the governance of its own people. Enemy of the Sun by Sami al-Qasim. I may, if you wish, lose my livelihood. I may sell my shirt and bed. I may work as a stone cutter, a street sweeper, a porter. I may clean your stores or rummage your garbage for food. I may lie down hungry, O enemy of the sun. But I shall not compromise, and to the last pulse in my veins, I shall resist. You may take the last strip of my land, feed my youth to prison cells. You may plunder my heritage. You may burn my books, my poems, or feed my flesh to the dogs. You may spread a web of terror on the roofs of my village, O enemy of the sun, but I shall not compromise, and to the last pulse in my veins, I shall resist. You may put out the light in my eyes. You may deprive me of my mother's kisses. You may curse my father, my people. You may distort my history. You may deprive my children of a smile and of a life's necessities. You may fool my friends with a borrowed face. You may build walls of hatred around me. You may glue my eyes to humiliations, O enemy of the sun, but I shall not compromise. And to the last pulse in my veins, I shall resist, O enemy of the sun. The decorations are raised at the port. The ejaculations fill the air. A glow in the hearts and in the horizon. A sail is seen challenging the wind and the depths. It is Ulysses returning home from the sea of loss. It is the return of the son of my exiled ones. And for her sake and his, I swear I shall not compromise. And to the last pulse in my veins, I shall resist, resist, and resist. In 1971, while I served as a secretary for the legal defense team for the Angela Davis trial, Palestinians stood in clear alliance with her, and reams of letters poured in from Palestinian activists and prisoners around the world. Davis broke ranks with the Communist Party USA, who had been ardent supporters of Israel and has become an unwavering ally to the Palestinians through her work in collaboration with other scholars and activists, including Blacks for Palestine, Mecca, and the Movement for Black Lives, despite farcical so-called peace deals. Robin D.G. Kelly, a leader within the Boycott, Divestment, Sanctions movement, through his scholarship and activism, has challenged the myth of security that has resulted in miles of walls and fencing deterring Palestinians from moving freely within their own state. But mine is a personal story of how I thought of Palestinians as my cousins and the legacy I inherited from my parents, where their discrete resistance became my creative resistance. So know that there are millions of people who are not versed in the philosophical or ideological discourse of resistance, but whose moral compass points them on the road towards liberation. In these times, the quest for wholeness and compassion are real. For living life on what seems like the hourly brink of extinction deprives us of the visions, creativity, and inherent powers that allow us to breathe. I will not be dispossessed of my country, nor should my secret cousins, the Palestinians, be of theirs. At the very core of my soul, though too often gripped in the platinum pits of hell, where the forces of imperialism, 21st century colonialism, and racism are trying to remand us permanently, Edward Said's words have become my daily mantra. Humanism is the only, and I would say the final, resistance to have against the inhuman practices and injustices that disfigure human history. May his words and the refrains of allies, human rights, and anti-Black racism organization serve as anchors at the Mediterranean and the historical waters of the Atlantic for those committed to bringing their visions, practices, and commitments to social justice, anti-racism, and all the debilitating dogmas leading to the destruction of humanity and this planet on which we get to be in this most sacred and at times truly beautiful ritual called life. The dreams of those boys in Gaza surfing at the sea, the girls in Hebron doing complex math computations and striding with the stance of leadership in their spine, and the teenagers at American Beach are due that rightful inheritance that their ancestors planted as a legacy for them. Thank you.
You're listening to Arab Voices on KPFT Houston 90.1 FM. This is Said, executive producer and host of Arab Voices. That was part one of the Palestine Center's annual Edward Said Memorial Lecture with Daphne Muse, a writer, poet, cultural broker, and veteran of the civil rights movement. We will air shortly some of the questions and answers that followed her talk. But I want to take a minute to remind you that KPFT is currently in membership drive, and your financial support is essential to the continued growth of KPFT, this commercial-free community radio station. Because KPFT relies on you, the listeners, for support. Yes, this non-profit organization is 100% supported by you, the listeners, to operate. So please consider a contribution today by calling 713-526-5738 or make that pledge online at kpft.org. or by texting the word GIVE to 713-526-5738. We look to you to support radio programming that you value on KPFT. Every dollar makes a difference in the quality of what you hear on KPFT. How about a pledge of $120? That translates into $2.30 per week, less than the cost of a cup of coffee. Think about it. For $2.30 a week contribution, you listen to what KPFT brings the greater Houston area, a wealth of local and national programs 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. And as I mentioned before, unique programs like the one you are listening to right now, Arab Voices, that has been on KPFT for over 18 years, covering a wide range of topics, with over 1,000 expert guests appearing on this program from around the globe. Please make that call, 713-526-5738, and support your commercial-free community radio station. Every call makes a difference, and we greatly appreciate it. 713-526-5738, or do it online at kpft.org. We will continue now airing the Palestine Center's annual Edward Said Memorial Lecture with Daphne Muse, a writer, poet, cultural broker, and veteran of the civil rights movement. Next, we will listen to some of the questions and answers that followed her talk.
Okay, well, thank you very much, Daphne. That was really quite compelling. If I may, Muhammad,
course, yeah, of course.
Yeah. Thank you, Daphne. That was quite compelling and quite touching. And more importantly, it really just laid out the commonalities of the struggle, the same pain that Palestinians and African Americans may feel, and you know, the camaraderie and the struggle, the pursuit of freedom, and the pursuit of to escape violence that is imposed upon them for no other reason than racism, basically, and the exploitation. You mentioned a great many wonderful human beings in the American Black community, the African American community, the leadership, and so on. You mentioned names that are friends of mine. I just want to go over Stokely Carmichael, Kwame Ture, who was a yes. very close friend of mine. We were, you know, definitely comrades and close friends all throughout. You mentioned Angela Davis, and I remember distinctly when Angela Davis basically broke away from the Communist Party at the time and supported the Palestinian struggle. So I remember that. I mean, just you raised so many things for me that are really personal in many ways. You know, and whether it's also the struggle as a student and all these things, you know, my forays into Oakland and Compton and many other places in California or Chicago or in Milwaukee or many, many other places all throughout the past so many years. And, you know, I look at this and I look at the violence that is being inflicted on African-American men for being Black in this country. I mean, I look at since George Floyd, there's been something like 100, I mean, lots of killings of African Americans and so on. This year, I think there was 164 killings of Black Americans for no other reason except for being Black, and just raises, you know, the image of in my own community, my own family, only a month after George Floyd was killed, was murdered. The same thing happened to a young relative of mine at a checkpoint for being a Palestinian while driving, you know, 28 years old. So the similarities are amazing. You know, when I can't breathe, you know, just raises all kinds of images. And my question to you, I mean, you raised so many issues. I'd love to ask you 1,000 questions, but I wanted to ask, despite all this commonality, there seemed to be an element of disconnectedness between African Americans and Palestinians. There's somehow, despite the commonalities, despite you know, the struggle that is really strikingly similar, what we see there seemed to be, you know, or at least for the Palestinians, there seemed to be a missing link, so to speak, in terms of reaching out to Black Americans and solidify that struggle and basically produce the kind of results that we all want. So I want to go back to your issue of intersectionality. And where are these gaps and how can we overcome these gaps?
Well, I think, first of all, the context of, I want to clarify that what the time that my parents seeded Palestine in my spirit and my mind was in, started in the 50s, went through the 60s and 70s, and Palestine was covered in the media very, very differently at that time.
Right.
And because of, I think, the charisma of Yasser Arafat, because of his charisma, the coverage, and an interesting little point that a lot of people don't know about, one of the largest Arab community in the United States at the time I was growing up was Detroit. And I think that still may be true. And there was a lot of connection between Blacks working in, especially the car plants in Detroit. And so there were places where there was interaction, there was social interaction, political engagement, and also at the time emerging in the 60s, you had the voices of people like Stokely keeping Palestine on the minds of people. But I think that part of the irony of this situation is lots of Black people go to Jerusalem, Black Christians. and they go, and it's as though the Palestinians don't exist. They don't talk about interacting with Palestinians. They talk about their the Christian experience that they have, the pilgrimage. So in far too many ways, Palestinians have been rendered almost invisible. And some of it, I think, much of it has to do with the pillaging of the land and the fact that even though you have social media, which provides instantaneous connections for people, I think it has been that the walls that keep being thrown up make it much more difficult for those alliances to maintain a kind of strength and a bond that I wish could be seen. And again, the media coverage of Palestine as a terror state is what most people see. They do not get to see the day-to-day lives, the aspirations, the children playing, a country trying to hold on to what it has and build a future, but at the same time that is debilitated by the destruction, settler colonialism, on a daily basis. So that's part of it. And I also think that the overwhelming conditions of the United States right now makes it even more complicated for those alliances to be built, and that you don't have the strength of a black press that needs to exist in order for a different kind of coverage to take place.
Excellent. I have one other question to you, because I have, you know, I am someone who has been instilled with the Palestinian struggle in America for a very long, long time. And in terms of building alliances and trying to reach out to all different communities, including the African-American community, probably more so than other communities. But I, you know, I am afraid that the Palestinians have failed to reach out to grassroots organizers, you know, within the African-American communities. Sure, they were, you know, they established connections and relations and so on, and they tried to court African-American leadership, such as Jesse Jackson and others. You know, they're reaching out to the Congressional Black Caucus, other community leaders and so on. But they're always there, and I'm thinking until today, there's something missing in terms of trying to reach out to grassroots African-American organizations to have an impact. And my question to you is, how best can they, you know, where should they go? What community they should reach out to? Should they reach out? You mentioned, you know, auto workers and unions and so on, trade unions, which is a great place to begin, but also, you know, students and so on, you know, the student organizations, or maybe, you know, maybe should reach out to, I don't know, some of the progressive churches and all that. So I just like your take on this.
The church, especially the black church, pretty absent right now,
right,
in the larger discourse of progressive politics. I think that the Black Lives Matter movement, the movement for Black Lives, the Middle Eastern Children's Association, I think there are just so many people at the grassroots level trying to do the work, and I'm not sure how the information is being translated to Palestinians, how the efforts of the organizations here in the United States, and not just the United States, there, you know, there's some pretty powerful, there were some pretty powerful organizations in South Africa for many years that had strong connections to Palestine. But I think that the young people, through the music, through the poetry, are making efforts, but sustaining those efforts is so daunting. And in a time of COVID, it's even more complicated. But how you thread those connections, how you forge them from community to community, from our small communities here in the United States to villages in Palestine. How do you keep those connections going when almost every effort is sabotaged? I think that the scholars, a number of the scholars around the world, Palestinian scholars, are doing some pretty good research that may be helpful. I think the SNCC Legacy Project is generating some really good ideas. I think one of the things that might be helpful is to create almost a map that could be shared with Palestinian organizations, and the map would show where different organizations are, and then use the map to link to what these organizations are doing, and then create a similar map in Palestine, where you say, here in Hebron is an organization that's doing parallel work to what's being done in Milwaukee, and then forging those links accordingly. But again, and I hate to keep saying but, voices are smashed, are suppressed, just like the voter registration and voting efforts here in the United States are being brutally suppressed. The efforts and attempts made by these alliances are, it's very, very difficult to keep them going and to make the connections. I think that for an example, the Highlander Center in New Market, Tennessee, which has existed since, I believe, the 20s, is doing a lot of work around community organizing, very interested in what's happening in Palestine, and that linking back to the churches. When churches have these pilgrimage, American churches, Black American churches, have these pilgrimages to Jerusalem, they need to make greater efforts to connect with the Palestinian people. I know that that is given the way the Israelis have configured security and walls, that is very complicated to achieve, but I think even just the voices of the churches coming forward to saying, we want these alliances. Jerusalem is important to our faith, and the Palestinian people and their history is important to it.
That could be a counterbalance for the Zionist evangelicals that are a base of support for Mr. Trump and Netanyahu, the Israeli prime minister. That could be quite effective. I have lots of things to ask, but I think Mohammed has questions from people who are watching and listening. So go right ahead.
Yeah. So we got a couple of questions that you've actually addressed, but for example, how can Black people and other people of color increase their awareness of the Palestinian struggle as well? But and I think you touched on that as well. But another thing that was asked is, you mentioned that your parents influenced your interest in the Palestinian struggle. And was this interest common in the Black community, or was this rather atypical?
You know, I'm not certain. I just don't. I don't have empirical data to prove that. But what I do have is within that, my father was part of an organization called the Private Butlers Association. Those men heard so much state secrets because they were invisible men.
Right.
And they would, at parties, you know, family gatherings, they would have these, again, they didn't go into, they were discreet, but they had their ways of through codes and, man, you know, it's jacked up what they're doing to the Palestinians. Why? And they would, the conversations would carry curiosities forward for me and make me dig deeper into reading about Palestine. And again, a lot of that was based on, I wanted to become a cartographer, you know, a map maker. And just seeing how the world was configured and why certain people lived in certain places that they lived and how they lived. So there was a lot of discussion among the people who were a part, who were connected to my parents. Again, they did not speak in the sophisticated terms of the ideology or the philosophy, but just as everyday working class people. And so it really set something in me early on. And again, the parallel between, and what inspired me to become a creative activist based on my parents' discrete activism. The world really is, as there was a Ray Charles, it's not the title of a song, but it's a phrase within a song. The world is in an uproar and the danger zone is everywhere. And the danger zones just implode on a daily basis, and it just makes it so much more difficult. But what I would say to parents is, bring the world to your children. Bring the world to how it really rolls for everyday working people who are trying to make a way out of no way. Because the voices of the elite, the voices of power, are heard all the time. Voices of people who comprise a country, who make it, who really make it work, those are the voices that are diminished on a regular basis. So as parents, as cousins, as friends, as educators, we can play the role in seeding future generations on how the world, the axis on which the world really should turn.
And so another question is, in a little more detail, could you explain how Edward Said and his writings resonated with you and your attitudes towards the conflict with the Palestinian struggle and the similarities between Palestine and Black people in America?
For me, the history and education that he brought in his writings mapped it out for me, that there were things that I certainly did not understand about the history of Palestine. There were things that created a focus for me to understand more than what was seated with my parents and beyond the intersections of activism that I had. And actually, there is a book coming out by a scholar at UC Berkeley named Zeus Leonardo called Edward Said and Education. I don't know if that's the final title of the book, but that's the working title that I know of. I have not read the book. I only know that he is working on this book. And I think that that would provide a lot of background and detail. And I'm eager to read the book because I think of how Paulo Freire, the Brazilian educator and scholar, how Freire's work really served pedagogy of the oppressed, how that work really served as a base and foundation for bringing greater, a kind of radical literacy to people. So I think Leonardo's book may be in the tradition of Paulo Freire and carrying Edward Said's voice to an even greater audience.
Another question is, if you can touch on this, is can you say more about the similarities of day-to-day life between Black people in America and Palestinians?
I think that the most, unfortunately, the most obvious are the ongoing killings of people. The daily, almost daily murder of Black men and women here, and obviously the same thing in Hebron and Gaza. But and I just want to point out an irony. I'm not recalling his name in the moment, but a couple of days ago, a young black man was murdered by a policeman,
right,
a 22-year-old cop. This black man was an ardent advocate of the police, and according to media reports, a Trump supporter. There's so much irony that rests in that. But I also think, I've never been to Palestine. I've always wanted to go. Circumstances just never made it possible. But I have interacted with Palestinians here in the United States through the arts, through culture, through the activism. And there is a kind of joy. There is a kind of, despite everything, we're going to live, despite oppression, despite the enslavement of my ancestors, despite the atrocities placed on the necks of Palestinians and their children on an almost daily basis. There is a will to resist. But as I tell my friend, Mary Louise Patterson, I say, it's like toothpicks trying to fend off tanks. And there's a weariness that comes with that. But there's also a resolve that comes with it. And I think that that resolve is manifesting in the poetry and the art of this young woman that I have mentored for a couple of years now, Manar Harb, that it is now manifesting in the desire for, I read a recent article about an 11-year-old Palestinian rapper who's rapping about peace between Palestine and Israel. These children want peace. They also want their country. So that's some of the joy, the way we commune around food, the way we till the land. I mean, the fig and olive orchards, are as precious to Palestinian farmers as the watermelons and corn and rice in the southern parts of the United States to black farmers who are diminishing. Well, for a while, we're really diminishing in numbers. And now there's been a real upsurge in black farming, and a number of black women are becoming engaged. So the respect for the land is also something that we share in common, and the traditions that are anchored in the respect for the land, from planting on it to holding rituals on it, we share that. And the creatives, the poetry, the art. I think one other thing I would like to highlight, that the contributions that Palestinians have made to the world are so underestimated and not honored, that there are a number of Palestinians involved in the tech world. And one of the things that This Week in Palestine has done is that it really looks at the currency, the current temperature of the artists, the tech people, the educators, the scholars, and so that the global pulse of the Palestinian people and what they have contributed to the world needs to be of greater focus and deserves greater attention, in the same way that black people have had to push through every kind of barrier imaginable to have not only our voices heard, contributions that we have made to the building of this country, and that it is built on our backs.
What you just heard was a recording of the Palestine Center's 2020 Edward Said Memorial Lecture with Daphne Muse, a writer, poet, cultural broker, and veteran of the civil rights movement, discussing the similarities and intersections between Palestinian and black struggles for equality and justice, as well as their implications for the future. For more information about the Palestine Center, visit the organization's website, and that's www.thejerusalemfund.org. You're listening to Arab Voices on KPFT Houston, 90.1 FM. This is Saeed, executive producer and host of the show. Did you know that this program, Arab Voices, has been on the air since April 2002? That's right, over 18 years of weekly Arab Voices programming, covering different topics and more than 1,000 expert guests that have appeared on this show from around the globe. All of that has been possible because of your support to KPFT over the years, our community radio station. Because KPFT is currently in membership drive, please call right now to support KPFT at 713-526-5738 and make a tax-deductible contribution, or make it online at kpft.org, or by sending a text message with the word GIVE to 713-526-5738. We know that not everyone can contribute, but if you can and appreciate what KPFT brings you and everybody else every day, please consider a pledge, because KPFT relies on you, the listeners, for support. In fact, KPFT is 100% financed by listeners like you. The phones are open. There is room for your call. Help keep up the momentum. Please call 713-526-5738 or donate online at kpft.org. And that does it for the show today. Thanks for listening. This is Saeed, executive producer and host of Arab Voices. Until we meet next week.
You are listening to KBOO Portland.
Good morning and welcome to this month's episode of Voices for the Animals. This is a program where we give a voice to the sentient creatures with whom we share this planet. I'm your host and producer for this month, Michelle Coppola. Today we have a